Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This podcast is a Roifield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, Anna.
If country borders and grids can fascinate you, and state names intrigue you, if atlases, globes, city plans, subway maps, and of course, world maps are your thing, if you can name the capital city of Namibia, and if you get giddy about flags, you are in the right place. This is Map Corner, a podcast about the love of maps brought to you by Roifield Brown and Claire Asprey. Now, on with the show.
Hello and welcome to Map Corner. I'm Roifield Brown, who's somewhat cream crackered today, but I am 43 degrees and 34 minutes and minus 79 degrees and 38 minutes, which puts me back in the bosom of my family in Burlington in southern Ontario in Canada land. And as always, I'm joined by that most well-travelled of capable women. It's Claire Asprey, who's back from Oz. How was your holiday, Claire?
It was lovely. And a whole range of different locations, of which more in future episodes, no doubt. But I'm now back in my normal home coordinates, which I have written down somewhere, but I'll share some from other places that were different from that in future shows.
So you're back in boring Bedford?
It's not boring, it's lovely.
Folks, this is Map Corner, the podcast that is dedicated to the love of maps and to all things cartophilic. So, as I always say, if Peters is your projection, you're in the right place. And oh, it's funny enough, we have a question from a caller about projections. But today, it's a mapping free-for-all, folks. There is no form to this show other than it's loosely connected by a love of maps. Other than that, don't know. Don't know what we're going to talk about. Stuff, I suppose.
It's a mixed bag.
Exactly. A potpourri, so to speak.
Lucky dip.
We can keep going at this, can't we? Don't forget, folks, this is a brand new podcast, so we need you to review us on Apple iTunes. And I did say in the last episode we'd give you a roll call, but as Claire would no doubt attest, I've been all over the place trying to get this show done. Like, we should have recorded it last week, and then I got the time wrong today. It should have been earlier on this week. So we're going to do the roll call next episode. So if you want to hear your name mentioned on Map Corner, go on to Apple iTunes, write us a review, and your name will be read out. Now, Claire, in red.
So on this show, we have calls from Thomas, who has a question about the most livable cities. Megan asks about map projections, which ones we should trust. And I think there's probably an entire episode in that at some stage. Ken comes back with a dose of history about GPS. We love Ken, don't we? And Nicole, who asks about which city is a gourmet's delight.
Remember, this show kind of survives off not just mine and Claire's witterings, but also your calls. So quite simply, to get a call in, you go onto a thing called SpeakPipe. Quite simply, go onto mapcorner.space. That's the website. I know it's a bit of a funny URL. It's mapcorner.space. Type that in. Over on the little right-hand side, you'll see a red tab. Hit that and leave your question. But first, before the calls, it's an interview with Matt Brown from thelondonist.com, and he's the creator of some of the most tweetable, some of the most memorable maps of the moment. Here's my chat with Matt. Matt, for me, London's always been kind of at the centre of mapping. And I suppose I was kind of thinking about this yesterday, and I thought, why do I always think of London being a Brummie first? Is that because of Anglo-centric cultural bias, or is it because of the Greenwich Meridian? Why do you think that London is so central to our depiction and mapping of the world?
Oh, what a big question to start off with. I think you've also hit it by giving a list of a few reasons, and it's not one simple answer. Greenwich is a large part of it. Another large part of it, of course, London was the centre of not just the Renaissance, but the kind of later the Enlightenment sort of era, when places like the Royal Society first started laying down the laws of science and geography and rational thinking. And of course, you've got things like the Royal Geographical Society, the Royal Geological Society, all these institutions that are map-based or geography-based, all sprang up in London. And then you've got the cultural side as well. I mean, London's always been this huge centre of culture. And so out of it has stemmed various art forms and creative bursts. And part of that has fed into the mapping process as well, which I shall talk about later, I think.
So, you know, you talked about the Royal Geographical Society.
Yeah.
When you become editor-at-large of the Londonist, do you automatically get, like, ushered into the top table of that august establishment? Does that just, like, come with the job?
I should imagine they're not even aware of our website. very different circles, I think.
Are you quite sure? Because the Londonist is somewhat influential and totemic for a certain type of Londoner. So tell us about the Londonist and who exactly you guys believe actually looks at your website.
Yeah, sure. So we've been going now. We're purely a website, although we do the odd spin-off thing like a book or a podcast. But we are a website, and we've been going 15 or 16 years now, which makes us pretty decrepit and ancient by web standards, although we'd like to think we're still pretty fresh-faced and young. And the sort of scope of the site is anything and everything a Londoner might find interesting. So that's a mix of local news, transport stories, lots of history and features about where the city came from, where it's going, lots on architecture, just a personal passion of mine, and lots of maps as well, because I think maps are just sometimes the easiest way to tell a story in a succinct and engaging way. And our typical reader, there is no typical reader. They're anyone and everyone who lives in the city, and actually way beyond as well. We find we have lots of readers from all over the world who either love England or London or are expats living abroad.
Let's focus in on the maps, because you and I were kind of put together by somebody. We had a virtual handshake on Twitter, didn't we? Somebody says, dude, Royfield, you do maps. This geezer produces maps. I think you should meet if you don't already know each other. And like, oh, we don't know each other. So give us the history of the Londonist through the maps, and tell us about the reason why you fell in love with kind of cartography. Give us that whole story, and then we can go balls deep into mapping.
Okay. Well, I think I've always been into maps. I think a lot of people are. It's almost a cliche to say I like maps, because I think everyone does deep down, don't they? But I remember as a youngster, I used to read a lot of those sort of fantasy novels like Lord of the Rings or the David Eddings stories. And those, they always come with these beautiful maps at the start. And that got me into drawing my own maps of fantasy realms when I was young. And I've always been pretty poor at art. I'm not an artist. I can't draw very well, but map making was the way I sort of channel my creativity into trying drawing ranges of mountains that don't exist and rivers and things like that.
So for you, it was fantasy maps. It was a way of channeling your creativity and imagination.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I was creating my own version of Lord of the Rings, but only as a map. I didn't have the skill to write a story. The map was what it was all about for me. And then I kind of parked that interest, I suppose, when I went on to university and things. I studied chemistry and biochemistry, about as far away from the mapping world as you could get, really. And so I didn't really do much. But then when I moved to London, I became fascinated with the city and how it was laid out. I suppose I saw it like a science project for myself in a way. And I wanted to know every street. I wanted to know every park. I wanted to know every cool bar and everything to do with London. And that's when I didn't found Londonist or start Londonist, but I was there more or less from the start when I found these like-minded people who were also passionate about the city and wanted to tell its stories. And we started off mostly doing snarky takes on local news, if I'm being honest, and maps weren't really part of it in the early days. Any of your listeners who know the Gothamist website or Chicagoist, it's more akin to those in its earliest days. But as a couple of years went on, I thought, what new ways can we use to tell the story of London? And it's then that at the same sort of time, Google Maps started bringing out its My Maps interface, or whatever the precursor to that was called, where you could actually put together simple digital maps of whatever you wanted and publish them on the web. Very easy to use technology and a very easy way to tell a story. Now, I used it initially to map all the Wi-Fi spots in London, which seems a quaint idea now that everywhere's got Wi-Fi pretty much. But back in 2007, 2008, it was the odd cafe or the odd bar that would have Wi-Fi. So we made a map of all the Wi-Fi spots, and we actually sold it as an early iPhone app. One of the first sort of spin-off products we ever did. It did quite well, and it sort of gave me the flavor of building these maps in Google Maps ever since. And we still make them in Google Maps to this day. It's still the simplest technology for putting things like that together.
So I've bumped into many of your maps. Is it fairly safe to say then that maps are used as a way to create virality for the Londonist? It's a case of, I'm going to create a map on X. We know that basically people are going to share it. It's going to drive traffic back to the site. Is that fundamentally it?
That's a really interesting question. It's part of it. So for sure, we've made maps along those lines. I'll give you an example. We've got a show over in the UK called Great British Bake Off, where people compete to make cakes. So when the new series of that was coming out, I decided to take the tube map and change every single station name on that map to a baking pun. Like Baker Street is a very easy one to do. Baker Street. But I found one for all 270 tube stations plus the Overground.
Not in Hillgate. What's come up with there?
God, I haven't got it in front of me. What would I have done? Notting Hill Great for a cheese grater? No, it's probably something better than that. But I melted my brain coming up with over 400 puns for this map. But we knew that one would work as a kind of viral thing, so it was worth the probably 2 days of effort I put into it. So for sure, we've done that. But then we've done some pretty almost academic style maps as well. One of the earliest ones I did, 2009, I've always been obsessed with technology in the Second World War called the V2 rockets. I don't know how well known they are outside Europe, but at the tail end of the Second World War, Hitler's getting desperate. He launches the first rocket weapons on the UK and other countries as well. And something like 500 or 600 fell on the UK. And these were incredible technology for the time. They would actually fly into space. So people think Sputnik was the first thing in space, but the V2 rockets actually dipped into space and came down again faster than the speed of sound. You couldn't hear these things coming, and bam, they would completely wipe out a whole block all over London. This was happening. Terrifying weapons. And no one had ever really made a map of where all these things had landed. And it was a really interesting project to map, because you can still see the scars in the London landscape today. You go to Hackney Marshes in East London. Wow. From the ground, you can't really see much. There's a few duck ponds here and there. When viewed from Google satellite view, you can see this is a crater, and it dates from the Second World War. Elsewhere, where one of these things hit a block of houses, you'll see a nice Victorian terrace is interrupted by a 1960s brutalist concrete structure, and that's again where this rocket fell. So by mapping these things, you could kind of really get this nice satellite view impression of how the modern city was shaped by the scars of war. And beyond that, the most gratifying thing about this map of V2 rockets, as soon as we published it, we were getting loads and loads and loads of comments below the article from people who were there at the time. These are people in their 80s and 90s now, who were children at the time, and they remember these terrifying weapons hitting London. And they were leaving comments describing eyewitness accounts of the horrors, the sort of testimony that isn't necessarily recorded anywhere else. And they were recording this straight onto a map. And in one case, we even had two distant relatives who've not seen each other since the Second World War, who rediscovered each other in the comments field to that map, which was really gratifying for us as a fairly young website at the time to bring people together like that.
That map sounds like a Brexiteer's wet dream. it's interesting you say about like the stories and the recollections that kind of come from that. I used to live on Torbay Road in Kilburn. I lived there for about 6-7 years. Oh. And the house directly opposite. So it's this rather beautiful kind of Victorian road, and we had this terrace house, and the house opposite it, I'd never really noticed until the next door neighbor, lovely old lady, said to me that the house opposite ours had been bombed in the Second World War. And she said there was a single lady used to live there with her child, and they both died. And when you looked at the house, you could actually see on closer inspection that half of it, the brickwork, was newer than the other half. So it'd be, and it was exactly the story of, I don't know if it was a V2 bomb, but it was German bombing. And yes, and the evidence of the Second World War is actually all around us if you know what to look for. And as I said, you looked at it and you realised that the sandstone brick was newer on one half of it than the other, but it was still this Victorian house, and you know, this tragedy which kind of had taken place there. And there was my next door neighbour that remembered it. You know, she remembered, you know, the German bombing of that road. And that must be having like a profound kind of effect on people who can live through something like that. And then it's wonderful that you can kind of create a tool and then like actually to map that out. But as we kind of said, you know, London is kind of ripe for mapping. There's so many things about London are absolutely iconic, aren't they? So even like the shape of the Thames. You know, if you just put that squiggle on a piece of paper, people know what it is. Like the Isle of Dogs is very distinctive, you know, and of course it's kind of EastEnders, isn't it? You know, so many things about London have been iconic. But your mapping, which you do for the Londonist, isn't just London, is it? So one of the last things which I saw, and we had a little bit of a ding dong about this, was your literary map of Britain. Now, I'm a big fan of the Archers. Don't come much bigger than me. So it's so big that I have a podcast about it. Tell us how you go and map something like this. Is it a case of like you've just imbibed a whole load of, you just read a whole load of shit, basically, yeah, all your life, you know? And then how do you determine exactly where Ambridge actually is or supposed to be on a map, and how long does that take you? So let's go through that, and then let's just weave a path and end up wherever we end up.
Okay, there's quite a lot to unpack there. Maybe for your listeners' benefit, I'll just describe what this map is. So it's
okay.
It's the whole of Britain. I've not done Northern Ireland. I've kept it to Great Britain, so England, Scotland, Wales, and every single fictional location.
Why didn't you do Northern Ireland? Was it you didn't want to upset any kind of sectarian sensibilities? Or was
purely
it a case
for the very trivial reason that I wanted to call the map Fake Britain because it's got a nice resonance to it, whereas fake UK or fake United Kingdom just doesn't quite do the same thing. And so,
But you know what? That in and of itself is somewhat interesting, and it's something which we're going to talk about on Map Corner in a future show. But how many people really know what the United Kingdom, Britain, Great Britain actually mean, where they end, you know, start and end?
Very few. And even those who do think they know, including myself, often get it wrong. When you get down to the minutiae, you get down to places like, not that I want to call Jersey and Guernsey minutiae, but you know what I mean? Things like the Channel Islands.
That's exactly what you've done, sir.
Yeah. You know, those very wonderful islands off the south coast. And British Overseas Territories, how they fit into the picture. And it is such a tangled web that even Ordnance Survey have been known to get this wrong from time to time when they've been fighting back against people on the internet about certain nomenclature. They've got it wrong themselves. It's so complex. Because a lot of it is based on tradition, and then other parts of it are based on law and official definition. And there are clashes sometimes between the two and confusions.
I didn't know that, we're going off on a bit of a tangent here, but I didn't know until, I'm going to say 5 years ago, that Britain is the Union of England and Wales, and that Great Britain is England, Wales, and Scotland. I didn't know that.
Well, that's a debatable definition in itself. Some would say that. Others would say Britain and Great Britain are interchangeable. You could also use Britain to mean the main island, which is to say Wales, England, and Scotland, as a landmass, a geographical term, whereas Great Britain is that plus all the little islands like the Isle of Wight and the Shetlands and the Orkneys dotted around it.
But the Isle of Wight's part of England.
It is. It's part of England, but is it part of Britain or is it part of Great Britain? My understanding is yes to both of those, but there are alternative definitions which would not include it in Britain if you're just talking about the island of Britain. Mm-hmm.
You know, this is the type of nerdy talk that the listeners love. But anyway, let's go back to fake Britain.
Fake Britain. So it's a map of every single fictional location I could find. And that's not just TV, it's novels, it's graphic novels, it's computer games, poetry sometimes even, and also mythology as well. So there are various islands off Wales and Cornwall from kind of Arthurian legend or other kinds of antiquity, and they're all on this one map together, and I think we've got something like 800 locations on there now. It's taken a long time to put together,
but so you're still actually adding to it then?
I am, yeah. So it's a joint effort between me and I've got a co-creator in Wales who's helped me out a lot, especially with Welsh fiction. It's an area I've never read much, and also, so what we did, we produced a version 1.0 of this map. We put it on Londonist and invited readers to tell us what we'd missed, help fill the gaps in. And we've now had more suggestions from the readers than we seeded the map with in the first place. So it's very much a crowdsourced map of fake Britain.
And then let's zoom in on, I'm guessing you had the Crossroads Motel on there.
Yeah.
All right, great. All right, so from my hometown of Birmingham, right? That's a bad example because I'm presuming you're just going to slap it in the middle of Birmingham, aren't you?
I think it's south of Birmingham. It's quite well pinpointed, actually. I mean, nobody's watched Crossroads for a good 20 years or whenever it went off TV, so I barely remember it. I remember the theme tune. I remember both theme tunes, actually. I'm probably rare in doing it. but it's quite well pinpointed. All of these sort of shows, even the old ones, they have long, loyal fan followings, and they've all got kind of wiki pages where fans have tried to piece together already where these things are in relation to each other. And Crossroads is one of seven or eight locations in that show that are fictional but can be mapped. I can't remember the names of the surrounding towns, but they're all on this map I've made. So I almost didn't have to do much work beyond finding the right websites or talking to the right people to give me the information I needed. It wasn't me watching endless episodes of Crossroads and noting down every reference I could hear. It's all there on the web for you if you know where to look.
All right. So you pinpointed this map. You used Google mapping tools as a way of kind of like putting the whole thing together.
Not for this one.
Okay. Because I was going to say, so what did you actually use for this map?
This is just this is drawn in Photoshop. Well, I hand drew a map, scanned it in, and then traced over in Photoshop.
You hand drew a map?
Yeah. Yeah. Old school, I know. Yeah.
Who the hell are you, Mercator or something? What do you mean you hand drew a map?
Well, just pen and paper, and then you scan it in, and there you go. Then digitally improve it.
Oh. Right, well, props to you. This is the man who says you weren't very good at art kind of growing up, but you can just hand draw a map.
I can't draw a beautiful scene with people in it, but I can do mapping quite well. Well, reasonably well.
I don't know if you've seen this, but Al Franken, you know, the now somewhat disgraced American senator, ex-comedian, he can hand draw a map of the United States with the states in it.
Mm.
Blank sheet of paper, bang, 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 it is somewhat impressive. So if I was to give you a blank sheet of paper, right, could you get your Mulliken tie right?
Nope, I'd be all over the place. In fact, I've recently had a book out, Everything You Know About Planet Earth Is Wrong, and I go into some of these blind spots we all have for geography. And there's quite a famous one now, is if you imagine the UK or Britain or Great Britain or England, Scotland, Wales in your head, where is
the United Kingdom?
Yeah, we could do the United Kingdom. All you need is the main island, though. Where do you get to if you go due north from Cardiff? And it goes bang slap through the middle of Edinburgh.
What?
Edinburgh is due north of Cardiff, yeah.
Stop it.
It's bizarre. It's because
Yeah. The northeast of England does actually kind of like go kind of northwest. It's not straight, is it?
That's right. It's a problem in our brains. We like simplicity, and we picture the UK, or most of us do, as an oblong pointing straight upwards. But of course, it leans over itself.
Yes,
hunched over almost, to the extent that Edinburgh is due north of Cardiff. It's remarkable.
Good heavens. I thought you were going to say Liverpool and go, well, okay, that kind of makes sense. But all right, so you've done your map and it's been added to. So is that the fact that, in effect, you crowdsource, you get people to add, is that a kind of a common occurrence with maps and the kind of, that you create for the Londonist?
Yeah, increasingly so. I've pulled that trick a few times. It gets me out of a tight spot because if I'm ignorant about something, which in general I am, I can present it on Londonist as half complete and ask other people to help me fill in my ignorance and show me where I've gone wrong. And people fall over themselves to help out. So it's a good way. If you put something up and present it as this is a finished product, I'm very proud of it. It's brilliant. That's a great strategy in its own right, but people will start knocking holes in it left, right and center, and then you'll feel bad about yourself. And but doing it this way around, it gets everybody involved, and your mistakes are actually a strength because it brings in extra opinions and extra viewpoints that you maybe wouldn't have got. And I've been overwhelmed. My co-creator, Rhys Davies in Wales, I'd never heard of him until a couple of months ago, and he wrote to me with 5 or 6 pages of A4 of additions and corrections of how to adjust the fake Britain map, all of which I've made. And I had to make him co-creator after that because he's added so much to the map that his name deserves to be on it as well. So it's actually brought me together with a collaborator, and we've now gone on to make 2 further maps with more on the way.
Just before I leave this kind of fake Britain map, did you have Melchester in it, Matt?
Yes. Well, there's 2 Melchesters.
What?
There's the one in Roy of the Rovers team, isn't it? Melchester Rovers.
Yes.
I think that was down somewhere near Bristol. I hunted long and hard for where that was based, and I did find a very obscure reference in one of the comic books to where it was, and it's down somewhere near Bristol. What's the other Melchester? I forget.
I've got a sneaky feeling, Matt, that you and I are kind of a similar vintage, you know, like in terms of our kind of cultural reference points, you know, Crossroads and then Roy the Rovers, right? So you're a child of the 70s and 80s, but by the sounds of things.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's 1976.
Well done, sir. So, and the other Melchester is Thomas Hardy.
Yeah. Now Hardy, he must have supplied something like 40 names for the fake Britain map. Famously, all of his locations were made up, but based on real places. So that, to answer your very first question, how did I pinpoint these things on a map? Quite a few of them are really easy because people like Thomas Hardy, he just took cities and renamed them. And they're very clearly real cities, just with different names. So that was how I seeded the map in the first place.
Just to prove my... well, I will admit to you, listener, that actually I didn't know it was actually Thomas Hardy. And I had to go and Google this. But through the magic of editing, I could kind of pretend that I did know. But I lived in a place in Notting Hill called Weatherbury. And all of the blocks of that estate are Thomas Hardy references. So there was a Melchester just around the corner. And I didn't realise when I first moved there that these were Thomas Hardy references. I actually thought that whoever had actually planned out this whole estate was a Roy the Rovers fan, you know, and that Weatherbury was some team that used to play against Melchester Rovers. But anyway, it shows you my working class roots and the fact that I never read any kind of Thomas Hardy. So you create maps. They help bring people together. They help explain the world. They're a lot of fun. How far can you take this, Matt?
Ooh, well, the idea of doing fake Britain, obviously, lends itself to other places. And in fact, we're doing fake London at the moment because there was not enough room on that one map to get all the London locations. And I'm already up to 700 locations just in London.
What?
Yeah. So I'm going to publish that one in a week or two. And then we're going to take it on further. We've got the idea of doing a whole world atlas of fake stuff literary references from all over the world. We've already made a start in America, for example.
So I suppose, Matt, it isn't just a case of kind of fake Britain, but it's also it's a case of what other names do we call bits of Britain? Now, I'm a Brummie. And that means something to, obviously, people in Birmingham. The old name of my hometown was Brummagem, hence Brummie. And anybody in Britain knows what a Brummie actually is, but that doesn't really travel outside of the United Kingdom. One of the maps, which I absolutely loved that you did, was exactly that. It was the nicknames of Britain. So how much time and research did you need to put in to come up with that map?
Well, that was another one. We did it in a very similar way to Fake Britain by seeding it with all the ones we knew out of our heads or could easily Google. For instance, I was born in a town called Cleethorpes on the east coast of England.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, me and Mrs. Mangleoff neighbours were the two famous people. Well, I'm not famous, but she's the only famous person from Cleethorpes. Cleethorpes, for reasons nobody quite understands, has the nickname Meggies. So we say, are you going down Meggies at the weekend? Meaning, are you going to Cleethorpes Beach? And nobody knows why. And so I thought probably towns all over the country have similar inexplicable nicknames and some that are explicable. But it'd be great to put all these things on one map and have a kind of alternative geography of Britain where everything's given by its nickname. London, of course, is the Big Smoke or sometimes the Great Wen, a Wen being a boil or a pustulous growth. So London's always had lots of nicknames, but I didn't know any nicknames for Birmingham, for example, and Brum was actually the only one I could really find. Could you enlighten me? Are there any other nicknames for Birmingham?
It's Brum and we are Brummies. Though the one thing which I only discovered quite recently, and I thought I knew my Brummie history, was that Birmingham renamed itself in the late 18th century. But up until that point, it basically was Brummagem. And as the city becomes this kind of burgeoning centre of the Industrial Revolution, and the middle classes start to move in, your James Watt start developing the steam engine at Soho Workhouse in Birmingham, the middle class go, it sounds somewhat downhill to be in a place called Brummagem. So they renamed it, rebranded it Birmingham.
I think there was a lot of that. Yeah, I think Brighton went through a similar exercise.
Yeah, Brithel's home.
Something
yes.
like that, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if it was the same reasons, but it was about the same time it changed or settled down on Brighton.
I think with Brighton, it was when the Prince Regent kind of like was doing his thing down there and stuff.
Quite probably, but, yeah.
But Birmingham was one of the first, because Birmingham was the end of the 18th century, and I think Brighton is the start of the 19th century. Like, Brummies, we claim lots of firsts, of which people just go, whatever, right? And I think we're probably the first, or at least one of the first, in terms of a major city actually to completely kind of rename itself to, you know, come up with a more kind of modern sounding name. But the echo of Brummagem is still there in that we are still Brummies.
There's still that renaming thing goes on today. The town of Staines near London was recently renamed Staines-upon-Thames to make itself sound a little bit more posh, because, of course, Staines ain't the most pleasant of names, is it? My favourite on the whole map, though, we're going back to Brighton, the neighbouring town of Hove. Mm-hmm. Its nickname is apparently Hove Actually, because everyone always calls it part of Brighton.
Yes.
And to separate themselves, we're Hove Actually, so that's their nickname.
There is a whole kind of slew of English place names which do sound shit, like Barking. It's a real bad pun. I don't mean to say this, but is Barking to call somewhere Barking? It's just like, it's kind of mad. And then Slough.
Yeah, Slough's a famous
Slough
one.
Sounds dreadful. Yeah. Staines, you know, there is this, I don't know, but maybe we should revisit terrible place names.
Some of it actually, there's one called Penge in London.
Yes.
But Penge sounds weird to the modern ear because it's probably of ancient sort of Celtic origins, whereas most of our place names are Anglo-Saxon or medieval. Very few place names stayed with us from Celtic times, and Penge is one of them. And that's the theory as to why that sounds weird to the ear. I don't know if Slough is also in that category, but one or two of the others are.
Obviously, we have a passion for maps. Do you think that what you've really tapped into is seeing the familiar world, the familiar shape, whether it's the United Kingdom, whether it's London, but seeing it in a new way? And you think that that basically, and I mean this with all greatest respect, is your shtick, basically. It's showing somebody something which they kind of recognise, but giving it a new veneer.
Absolutely. And I think we've actually deliberately targeted that idea on Londonists many times. The most obvious example is the tube map. Everybody the world over has at least seen a tube map. We know what it is. Londoners know bits of it inside and out. So there's a whole genre of mapping, which is fake tube maps, which I'm not sure Transport for London, our local transport authority, is very chuffed with, because we're taking their copyrighted maps and then changing all the names and labels on it to either humorous things or even educational things in some instances. I made a tube map of medieval place names once, which is a way of showing what places like Notting Hill and I don't know, Barking used to be called in ancient times. So it's a kind of bit of fun, but you learn something at the same time. And I think that's what we're all about on Londonist. It's putting a smile on people's faces, but also teaching them something new about the city they live in.
Right. So you are the chief map man at the Londonist. But let's put map into one side and work. What else do you do? What else floats your boat, Matt?
Well, I love nothing more than just wandering the streets of London, and I guess that's a map related skill in itself, the exploration side. But I love going around just trying to spot things I never seen before. I've got a rule. I have to go in a new building every single day, or at least every single day I leave the house anyway. When I work from home, I don't do this. But there's so many cafes and bars in London, it's easy to do that. But there's also all the galleries and museums and things that you could find a new place every day quite easily. I'll always try and walk down a new road.
Is there some kind of Latin word for this weird obsession of yours that you need to walk into a new building every day?
The usual response is you should get out more, but it's kind of that's the problem. I get out too much and I need to restrain myself a bit. But it's exploration. It's building a mental map of the world. I mean, I can't escape. It's part of my being is mapping, even if it's not making a physical map. Learning how the city fits together in my head is who I am, really. That's everything I do.
Do you think that's what you are, really, ultimately, a frustrated explorer?
I think I'm a walking GPS unit, I think. I don't know. There was nowhere left to explore easily these days, is there? I mean, there are still untapped realms, like the whole of the seabed, or 95% of the seabed is unmapped, the whole of space. But you need some pretty expensive kit to do it. So the only place a normal person can explore is the city he or she lives in, and London is a beaut for that, because there are whole boroughs that even I've only been to two or three times, and within that borough there's 80,000-90,000 people and 2,000-3,000 roads to explore that I've never been down, and that's just one of the 32 London boroughs. It's an infinite city. It's illimitable. It's something you just can't possibly explore thoroughly, even if you had 10 lifetimes. It's such a challenge to try and get a head full of that city and learn it all.
You know what, though? Just whisper it to me. What is your least favourite London borough?
Sutton.
What's up with Sutton?
It's boring. In fact, I've already alienated the Channel Islands, and now I've alienated the whole London Borough of Sutton. But I once did an article called something like "Did anything interesting ever happen in the Borough of Sutton?" And I think I found five things in the whole of history that happened in the Borough of Sutton. One of which was a man being attacked by a lion. So that kind of makes it. The other four I can't remember. That's how uninspiring it was. So if any of your listeners know the London Borough of Sutton and can put me right, I'd love to hear some interesting tales from that part of South London.
Tell you what, Matt, just to end up, it kind of shows you how blind I am to detail. So we were given this kind of virtual handshake by a third party on Twitter. And it was only today when I looked at your email, I realised that you and I are kith and kin, sir. We are both Browns.
That's right, yeah.
So there was we did talk about this on the last map corner episode, but there is a wonderful heat map of British surnames, And I must admit, I didn't bother to put brown in. And what's the point of that? They're going to be everywhere. But I suppose in our dim and distant pasts, maybe we are related. So that's another kind of mapping link to us and whatever.
Oh,
so
you could probably have 10 shows on genealogical mapping. There's all kinds of conversations there, how people's surnames move around. And I've done some of that myself. And yeah, Brown is a really hard name to do. But one of my great-grandparents had the wonderful surname of Standaloft, which I presume was because some ancestor was very tall rather than being well-to-do or anything. But we're all from Lincolnshire originally, so the other side of the spine of the country to you as a Brummie. But yeah, Brown's everywhere. It's impossible to map them.
Absolutely. Matt Brown, thank you for coming on to Map Corner and shining a little bit of a light into the wonderful world of mapping London through the Londonist.
Thank you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hello, it's Mark here, otherwise known as Yokel Bear on the Twitters. This is my postcard for a place that I love, which is Avebury in Wiltshire. Now, I'm from Wiltshire, I'm from Swindon. And so Avebury, which is just down the road from Swindon, was somewhere where I spent a lot of my childhood. I used to cycle down there or go there with my parents. And it's a place that has always really stayed with me. Avebury, of course, is best known for being the site of one of the biggest Neolithic stone circles in Europe. And it's so big, the village is actually within the stone circle. And it's a very quiet, rural place. It's not a big village. But what really I love about Avebury is the feeling that you get, because this stone circle's there and we don't really know why it was there. Was it religion? Was it something else? And it gives a real spooky, unknown kind of atmosphere to the place. You can walk around the stone circles and there's giant ditches as well on the outside of the stone circles that you can, you know, it's a place that you can go, and when I was a kid I could go and play. But I became fascinated by the history. But it's also fascinated me because it's like the quintessential English countryside. It lies on the Ridgeway, which is a series of downs that crosses across the middle of England. So it's green fields and sheep and yellow fields of rape during summer. And
But in the middle of this, this structure, this unknown stone circle, and it really kind of, it creates an atmosphere that I just cannot get enough of. Also, as well, one thing that really influenced me was the children's TV series, The Children of the Stones, which was set in the made-up village of Millbury, but it was filmed at Avebury, so really it was about Avebury. And again, that kind of hooked into the kind of spookiness and the mystery of the place. The best time to go to Avebury, I think, is, you know, very often early spring mornings when there's fog and, you know, mist, just to really enhance the entire weirdness of the place. So, yes, that's my favourite place and that's my postcard. Go to Avebury. It's weird. It's strange. It's beautiful. So, yes, Avebury.
This part of the show is probably my favourite. I like it that you, the listener, send in your audio postcards. So I'd like to thank Mark Everdon, sometimes known as Yokelbert on the Twitter, for a wonderful snapshot of Avebury in Wiltshire. Thanks, Mark. Now, Colette, it's time for the calls. First off, we have...
Thomas?
Well, it's actually Nicole first off.
Okay. Well, I could read those out if you told me which order they were going to be in.
Well, yes. Doesn't matter. All right, first off, it's Thomas.
Hi, Royfield. Hi, Claire. This is Tom Daly from the American Biography Podcast. I was just wondering, what city is regarded as the best in terms of livability or best known for its urban planning? Thanks. I'll hang up and take my answer off air.
Great question. This whole thing about livability, something which is relatively new in terms of even having it as a thing, isn't it? I don't remember anybody talking about places that were livable in the 80s or the 90s. It seems to be like a noughties thing, which is, but it's a very good guide as to if a city or if a town is somewhat pleasant.
Yeah, and I think it's good. My sister moved to Canada, to Vancouver, well, off and on throughout the noughties. And I remember Vancouver being very highly rated on the international livability scale, whatever components made that up. All through that time. And I went to visit and it was very nice.
I went to Seattle for the first time last summer. Totally fell in love with it. Obviously, what I do is compare and contrast with my American home, which is San Francisco. And San Francisco is an exciting place. You know, it's very dynamic, but it's dirty, it's grimy, there's human detritus literally on the ground. And last year they started having human waste extractors, that's not the right word, patrols, there you go, because there's so many homeless people in some areas of San Francisco. And going from San Francisco to Seattle was an utter eye-opener. Seattle was so clean and so well-ordered. And I'd say to people in Seattle, oh, my God, you can eat your food off the floor here. And they'd all say, but you haven't been to Vancouver. That's what they all said in Seattle. And it was just so beautiful. So I had a look at the CNN. They're basically most livable cities in 2018. And other websites do this. But I think their list is the most authoritative. And number one. I know you're looking at this, but would you have guessed that number one was Vienna? I wouldn't have.
No, although some of those central European cities have had a real renaissance. I'm thinking of Berlin as well, which is incredibly fashionable. I'm not sure it's on the list, but it's something that, you know, seems to have a lot of cultural life reemerge. And I guess Vienna's already had a very strong cultural history anyway, and some great architecture, you know, and a river and stuff like that. People like that. So, you know, I was saved from Bedford. Everyone loves the river. So, you know, I think it's those some of the things that sit in the background of a place. If you can get that background right, some of the more other livable factors can sit on top of that. And that's a really good starting point.
And also it's to do with cost of housing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's the ease of and location to various resources. You know, is it easy to shop there? And also places that score high on the livable scale fundamentally, it's kind of families. It's, you know, are children safe? There is crime relatively low. Are the schools good? It's a whole kind of, it's a whole kind of a mixture of things. But to just go through this list. So number one, so really should do this in reverse order.
Can you play the Top of the Pops music over the top of this? That's a cultural reference that won't trouble.
So number 10. Number 10 was Adelaide in Australia. Number 9, Copenhagen, which I've been to. It's absolutely lovely. And then number 7 is a tie between Toronto and Tokyo. I'm surprised that Toronto is so high. I know Toronto very well. It's where I am at the moment. I would have said that the livability index of Toronto has actually gone down. I've been coming here for 20 years. There visibly are more homeless people here now in Toronto than there ever were 20 years ago. Like, you never saw any. And there are high-rise condos, apartments all over the lake in Toronto. So I'm surprised that Toronto is so high on this list. Vancouver, as we've said, your sister raved about it in the noughts. Sydney, Australia. Calgary, Canada. Number 3 is Osaka in Japan. Number 2 is Melbourne, which I think used to be number 1. And then number 1 was Vienna. But it's interesting that you look at the list and Australia has 1, 2, 3 cities, and Canada also has 3. So there's a large kind of cultural kind of component there, to do with the equitability, and that's not quite the word, and I've definitely mangled saying it, of the societies where those cities actually reside.
Yeah, and the kind of the Nordic cities are generally seen in within Europe as really nice places to be.
One thing that people say to counter this livable cities thing, and I think they kind of put this into the mix, but it's always one of the things people say about Switzerland. Yeah, it's great, but it's boring.
Yeah.
And you kind of have a feeling that some of these cities, like Calgary in Canada, you know, if you're really into the arts or you're into anything kind of cutting edge, I don't think I'm going to be, you know, decamping off to Calgary anytime soon. I can't speak for Osaka and definitely can't speak for Adelaide and stuff. But generally, you know, cities which are big and vibrant aren't seen as necessarily livable, but they're seen as exciting places, aren't they? So your New Yorks and your Londons.
Yeah, so if you're judging livability by safety, sometimes there's a correlation between safety and perceptions of being dull. And actually, there's a really good book written by Mark Lawson, who's like the cultural commentator, who wrote a sort of travel book about 20 years ago called Journeys to All the Safe Places or something like that. And he does go to Middle America and he goes to Canada and he goes to Australia. And it's really funny because he writes this sort of section all about how Australia is brilliant and colourful and marvellous, and then he goes to the boring places in Australia to explain about why they're different. So yeah, some of the places that do score well are perhaps the ones that are seen as less edgy, which, you know, not everyone wants to be edgy, I guess.
And especially if if you're bringing up a young family, you don't need edge, do you?
No,
that's
no.
The last thing you want. Absolutely. You just want utter safety. And it's interesting being physically in Burlington, which is part of Greater Toronto. This is a suburb. There's no two ways about it, with strip malls. And visually, it's very boring. You look at the range of businesses that are here to do with just cuisine, just eating out. It is a case of, do you want pizza or do you want a burger or maybe another pizza or maybe another burger, you know, and then there's the odd shawarma place kind of thrown into the mix. And what places like this suffer from is an energy drain, you know, when teenagers grow up and they go, my God, the place almost feels stultifying. And then they want to get into the big city, don't they? You know, and they want to see diversity in all forms, you know, whether it's people of different ethnicities, and then that's recognized by then food that they find on street corners, and then musical choices, bars, and just not to see the same old bloody faces you've seen for the first 18 years of your life.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that you have this constant move of people as they go through life cycles, where you start off on your adult life, and you want to go into the big city because it's seen as somewhere exciting. But then as you go through your adult years and you decide you want to start a family, somewhere which is livable is very high absolutely. On your list.
And it's you see that in the demographic flows in and out of London. So the places around the edges of London, you know, kind of Hertfordshire, Surrey, places like that, they have a really interesting demographic shift where the younger people go in and then they all come back in their sort of 20s or 30s. You know, it's really notable when you see the stats.
We should really talk about human patterns of migration, whether it is internationally and then nationally, on a forthcoming show, because it's something which I find endlessly fascinating.
Indeed.
and how cities, places, towns are definitely kind of, you know, reinventing themselves all the time and becoming attractive to different types of person. But the other part of Thomas's question was he talked about town planning.
Yay! I was hoping you were going to mention this.
So listen, I'm going to remove myself from center mic and pass it over to you, Asprey. Go.
Oh, no, well, I love a bit of urban planning. In another life, I might have been a planner. If I only hadn't discovered it too late in life. But it's interesting when they're asking about which places are well known for doing good urban planning. And when I was sort of looking into that, some of it is about small parts of cities that otherwise are not particularly well planned, that, you know, maybe the good bits are notable because they stand in contrast to the rest of the place. But I would like to put a shout out for Ebenezer Howard, because he invented the whole thing anyway, with his Garden Cities of the Future, which I have read for my postgrad in housing. So, you know, I speak as I find with the whole Garden City thing. And also I learned to drive in Letchworth, which was the first Garden City. And the concepts there were great. I think they probably haven't always kept pace with the way that modern life works and the way that massive kind of economic sub-regions function. So I don't think he contemplated sort of mass transport and cars in the way that he could have. Well, obviously it was the early 1900s, so, you know, how was he to know that Letchworth would be basically a sort of satellite place where people commuted from into London? But that wasn't the point of it. The point was to live, work, and have access to the countryside all very close at hand. And I think that's a really great starting point for any place, really. So, you know, take a chance to go and see Letchworth if you can. They've got a wonderful heritage museum there as well.
So apart from him not foreseeing the rise of the car, have his other theories on what makes a place livable, from the ground up, you know, I'm going to plan it from a blank sheet of paper, have they held up?
I think some of it does. So there was some of it was around affordability, and some making, you know, cottages that were available to, you know, people on modest incomes, not the most cheapest versions, but, you know, modest incomes. Some of it was about the quality of design, and there's some lovely design, although these days it's a bit sort of old-fashioned looking, and some of those homes don't always stand up brilliantly to modern life, some of them look very pretty. But actually I think the most important thing about Letchworth Garden City, which there's been a bit of a renaissance for people who are listening around the world, there's been a bit of a renaissance in the concept of new towns and garden cities across the UK in various sort of moments of government exuberance and excitement in the last 10 years or more. And the version of what they mean by garden city or new town has changed a number of times in that concept. But for me, Letchworth got it right, especially because it captured land value. And this is a bit geeky, but they have the Letchworth Heritage Foundation, which basically held all the freeholds of a lot of the land and owned the town mm-hmm. centre and so on. And actually, it then just reinvested the growth of value back in the town. So there's a huge amount of community value created in Letchworth, which the modern development sort of structures where you just, you know, people sort of buy it and no one has that long-term interest, and everyone who captures private value just cashes it in, and there's no community value left in it, doesn't replicate. So I'd be really keen to see a return to that kind of thing, which is similar to what you get in a community land trust, to be fair. That would be great. If we could take one thing away from Letchworth as a model, I think it would be land value capture. But that is me getting on my geek soapbox, frankly. So, you know, it's also nicely laid out and beautiful to look at and got beautiful green spaces and, you know, nicely laid out roads, ways and sensible sort of spacing.
We should get Ben Jacobs on, who's on the first couple of Map Corners mm-hmm. as a who left calls, because he actually is an urban town planner. And I forget where for. It's somewhere in Massachusetts. It's not Boston. Maybe it's, you know what, I think it's kind of like Connecticut, Rhode Island or something. It's round there. It's in New England. And Ben has got a big brain for this mm-hmm. stuff. But, it, you know, for people that aren't quite aware of what an urban planner does, so they look at issues to do with sustainability, pollution, transport, including the potential of kind of transport, obviously crime, land values, economic development, social equity, which is a little bit what you just kind of touched on, zoning codes, and there are other bits of legislation, but it's a whole kind of mixture of those types of things. And I just find them endlessly fascinating. And talking about where I am now, physically in Burlington, which is a town, which is, they call it a city. In Britain, I think we'd call it a town. It's got a population of about 180,000. And it you can literally drive down any road unless it's rush hour, and it always feels dead. There's a lack of what I call street mm-hmm. theatre. And you get to all these intersections, because it's North America, a lot of the roads are straight, which I think is actually a good thing. To be able to have a clear line of sight, to know where you're mm-hmm. going. So you orientate yourself. But unlike, let's say, a European city, or let's say a large North American city with straight roads, each intersection has some kind of strip mall. And the theatre, what your eyes are drawn to are car parks or parking lots, as Americans would call it, with businesses around. And it doesn't feel organic. And actually, there is no human bustle at all. And you just think, my God, right? Why can't the car parks, the parking lots, be behind the shops? So the shop fronts are directly on the street. It creates visual spectacle. It differentiates every intersection, so you actually know where you are, you know. And I'd be totally fascinated to have Ben on a show. Now, we should maybe do it where he's on mic, so we don't just have an interview. So you can ask him questions. You can geek out and do all of your urban stuff.
Well, I'm spending all weekend reading our neighbourhood plan. That's my next thing. I've got to sign off on, we've got a committee on Monday to sign off the wording of our neighbourhood plan for our village. So I've been involved in some planning for the last 5 years for my very little village.
You, my God, aren't you the rip-roaring exciting person?
Yeah. I do placemaking at work, and then I come home and do it for where I live too.
All right. So hopefully, Thomas, we've half answered your question there. It's going to CNN. The most livable city in the world is actually Vienna right now. But Australia scores very highly in these things. Australia and Canada always score very highly. Next question is from a stalwart of the podcast. Yours blows our doors off when every call's in. It's Ken McDonald.
On May Day 2000, President Bill Clinton changed the world of mapping forever by ending selective availability, which had severely limited the use of the global positioning system by non-military personnel. The onboard satellite navigation systems in cars and smartphone apps would come later, of course. At the time, few civilians appreciated the decision aside from a handful of map geeks on a Usenet group called sci.geo.satellite-nav. Don't you miss Usenet? One of whom, a guy in Portland, Oregon named Dave Ulmer, promptly went and hid a 5-gallon bucket of trinkets in a park and posted the coordinates to the Usenet group. He called it a geostash, but as such things proliferated around the globe, the term changed to geocache, and since then they've been monetized by geocaching.com, and there are over 3 million of them around the world. I found my first geocache 2.5 years after that first hide. It's an activity of natural appeal to a map geek, isn't it? The bucket in Portland is long gone, replaced by a plaque honoring it, but I have found the oldest extant cache in the world, placed in western Kansas on May 11, 2000. My wife, Jen, is from western Kansas, so I thought it would be convenient when we were visiting her childhood home, failing to fully grasp the scale of the American West. Turned out to be a 4-hour drive each way, but well worth it, giving me a visceral sense of the vast, windswept expanses of the high plains, so barren, cold, and dry that late December day. Contrast that with the time I went to find the oldest cache in the United Kingdom, placed high up on Ben Moor back in December 2000. It was an unusually warm, sunny summer day for Scotland. I parked on the edge of the A85 and started along the footpath, accompanied by my newlywed wife and our friend Nora. As the trail began to ascend, my wife chose discretion as the better part of valor and returned to rest in the car, something perhaps she's had to do a bit too often, thanks to geocaching. Nora stuck with me until it came time to go off-trail up a grassy mountainside that appeared to be about a 45-degree pitch. She bid me adieu there, as I followed my GPS receiver arrow pointing nearly vertically, literally grasping at tufts of grass as I scaled the cliff along a gurgling beck that dropped like a waterfall to my left. Getting back down was basically a semi-controlled series of falls, but I did find the cache first, accompanied only by a few incredulous sheep, and I enjoyed tremendous views of the highlands all around. I hardly cache anymore, and GPS has become quotidian, the thing on my phone that's taken the place of looking at a map before going somewhere I've never been. But I remember it fondly, do mean to get back to it, and certainly recommend it to all my fellow map geeks out there.
Thanks, Ken, and I love the idea of geocaching. I've been hankering to do it for ages. I just haven't found a map-friendly friend to do it with, and it felt a bit sad to go out on my own. But then maybe you've inspired me to leave unenthusiastic people behind and just tread on and do it, strike out by myself and do it by myself. So I'm going to give it a go. And it would be great to hear from other people who also do geocaching about, what kind of things they found, where's the most unusual place they've been, what's the most unusual thing they found in a geocache. I know a friend of mine did it recently and was very keen, and her kids enjoyed it too. And my daughter doesn't ever like to leave the house, so she's not a prime contender for geocaching joy. What do you think, Myfield? Would you do it?
Mm. You know what? I've never done it. And it's funny, right? I think being into maps is the most natural thing in the world. But other people tell me it's quite geeky. Now, I see geocaching as extremely geeky. However, there is not a negative, Ken, because actually when I want to be you, Ken, you Ken sounds like the coolest person with the best gizmos and whatever.
And the most patient wife, because I'm not sure I would drive 4 hours to just look at something that I found in a tree and then put it back and drive home again.
Exactly. There is a level of obsession that seems to go with this stuff, which I don't quite think that I have, but people tell me that I have it, but just in other ways. So I look at it and marvel, but I'm also in part somewhat scared.
We did something similar to this once at a staff away day where I used to work, where we were all sent off around mm-hmm. London to do this sort of treasure hunt. With these sort of clues that were linked to a mobile phone thing. And so that was a similar sort of experience. And actually, it was quite a lot of fun. And if you're going to be at a staff away day, It does help to get out of the room and walk around a bit. So, you know, it does put a bit of energy back in the group.
But talking about the group, because what we are trying to do here is to create a community of cartophiles.
Yeah. So if anyone wants to go geocaching near Bedfordshire, come give me a ring.
Well, that's not where I was going with this, Claire. You jumped in too soon. Right.
I'm just desperate for a friend to go geocaching with.
I'm sure there are suitable websites for that.
Oh, I'm whatever. Sure there are.
So you can hook up, have your illicit hookups. But if you remember back, I think it was like episode two, if you remember back that so far, I said that we need a common identifier. And I threw it out there that maybe this should be the amount of countries that we've been to. So that would make me, I don't know, like a, I think I'm a 29. I can't quite remember now. And now when I said this on the group, a couple of people said, that sounds like you're a bit braggadocio, Royfield. And it wasn't at all meant to be that way. And one of the people that actually said this was Ken.
I know. And you can't fault the guy's enthusiasm for getting out and about.
No, exactly. He gets out and he likes a map and also somewhat knowledgeable and somewhat persuasive. So it wasn't meant as a braggadocio thing, though there is an inherent value put on a number. You know, somebody says, I am a number one, right? That's either you are the best or it means you haven't done very well at all. If somebody then says, I'm a 29. So you understand the value judgment that somebody else would put on it, even though that wasn't meant it wasn't meant in that way at all. It's quite simply just a way for us just to signify that we are part of the collective that is Map Corner. So this sparked off somewhat of a debate. And I think one of our listeners, somebody on our Facebook group, came up with an elegant solution, Claire. Who is it and what was the solution?
Okay, the solution comes from Chris Malcolm, who says that many countries have a significant national day or date in the year, and we could pick the day that's closest to our birthday, for example. And then we would be named after the nation that has a national day closest to our birthday. So we don't have to travel anywhere for that. We can just look it up.
Awesome. Now, what I'm going to do, folks, I'm holding myself a hostage to fortune. I'm going to find said site, which has the 195 countries of the world on and what they're national days or Independence Day is, and then quite simply you go on there, have a look, and you go, oh, I'm born on the 1st of July, that means I'm a Canada. So you say, hello, my name is Fred and I'm a Canada, and we all know that we are hardcore Map Corner geeks. So that's what we're going to do. So thank you, Ken, for steering me away from the numbers. And then thank you to who was it again, Claire?
It was, oh, you've put me on the spot there. I was looking up what my day was. Chris Malcolm.
And thank you to you, Chris, for coming up with a rather elegant solution, which, as Claire says, you don't need to travel anywhere to be a citizen of not only the globe, but also of Map Corner by having your country designation. So that's what we're going to do. So next time you call in, you know what to do, folks. Claire. Shall we have another call? Awesome.
Let's do that.
Hello, my name is Nicole, and I'm calling from San Francisco, California. And I was wondering what your thoughts are on cities in Europe to eat in. In particular, I'm thinking like the best places to eat in. In particular, I'm thinking of Paris versus London. I've been to both a number of times, and in Paris, I find that in sort of the nicer restaurants, the menus have weird pieces of animals that I've never heard of before, like intestines and, I don't know, brains that I have no desire to eat in. And then the lower, less expensive restaurants kind of have the same meal of pizzas and salads. So, I love Paris and I love eating there. But London seems like it has a lot more options with the curries and of course, the sort of gourmet pub foods and I don't know, so many different things to choose from. So I'm wondering what your all's thoughts are on that. Thank you very much.
What do you reckon, Clary?
Oh, well, I've never been to Italy, but I understand that's a pretty good place to eat in terms of cities of Europe. So I would guess that would be fairly high on the list. I mean, it depends what kind of food you like, I guess. I'm a vegetarian, so living in Spain was fun. Wasn't a huge amount on offer. And some places are better for different kinds of things. So I don't know. You're a very well-travelled man. What's your reckoning on good places to eat in Europe?
I disagree with the first thing that you said. But I have to qualify it. I've spent a lot of time in Italy. And it's one thing to jump off an airport, go and visit family and friends, and invariably they'll take you to nice restaurants. They cook you great food, and then they'll say, you know, third or fourth night out, let's go out. And they're not going to take you to somewhere crappy. You're not going to go to the Italian equivalent to McDonald's. So you get somewhat of a distorted view in terms of the strength of retail cuisine of a country, of a place. It's only when you independently travel and you travel on a budget that you really see a country, a region in the round. And actually, there's two things. There's a quality of food, and then there is also choice. And if you want choice, Italy's the wrong place to go to. You can travel up and down those autostrada, and all you'll get is cheese and ham, more ham and cheese and a bit of bread, you know. And then you're craving for a burger or for a Chinese or just anything. You're craving for, like, if you want a Thai meal, you know, there's an argument that says go to Thailand. But we do live in a globalized world that if you find yourself spending, let's say, a month in Torino, you realize there isn't the diversity of other cuisines. And that is in part because Italian cuisine is so good. So, and I love Italian food, but fundamentally pizza, pasta, lasagna, et cetera, it becomes a bit of a oneness after a bit. But also, it's one of the things which Italians are incredibly proud about is the strength of their cuisine. And it's one of the ways of Italy has displayed soft power throughout the world. You know, literally every city in the world has an Italian restaurant showing, you know, the Italian tricolor. So there are other, you know, benefits to having this strong culture around food, but it kind of knocks out all comers when you go to Italy.
I went to gelaterias in three cities in Australia, and I had gelato. So that will tell you something about the Italian soft power of food.
Exactly. Those Italians, you know, first you had the Roman Empire, then you had the gelaterias and the pizzerias, you know, the second and third Roman Empires, you know, after that. So the best places in terms of, and here's another thing, being in California, and I frequently say, in as a retort to Californians who slag off Britain, they say, oh, it's all just like bangers and mash and stodge and pies in England, and they kind of laugh. And I go, when's the last time you were actually here? You know, you go to London, and I would say you're going to struggle to find a better city in the world for diversity of food. The only obvious cuisine which is relatively poor in London in terms of numbers would be Mexican or Latin American, considering how strong those food cultures actually are. You're not going to see that many Mexicans and stuff. There are some kind of chains now and stuff. But London, New York are just way ahead of any, I know obviously New York is not in Europe, but are way ahead of any other city that I've been to in terms of choice, diversity, and quality. So we're not talking about saying you're eating a Portuguese meal and going down to Nando's. You know, and Nando's is a popular chain in the UK for people that are outside of the UK. We're talking about individually owned restaurants by people who are from that country, or their descendants actually were, so that it's been passed down. And there is a love of that cuisine and the culture around it. And then, so when you eat, it isn't just you're eating food of that place, of that country, but there is almost a mystique around it, almost. So it's the difference between going to Pizza Express, which is a chain in the UK, then going to a neighborhood pizza restaurant where the guy inherited it from his grandfather, type of thing. So I've been to Paris and I found Parisian food actually quite stifling as well. But again, it's because of the pride and the inherent strength of that cultural tradition when it comes to food, that the French are just like, well, you don't want to eat anything else. French food's the best. And I kind of love that, but it does become, maybe I'm displaying too much of my British side here, in that historically British cuisine was nothing to write home about. So we've adopted the food of the world. So you can, as I said, you can go to London and eat out throughout the world and come back on yourself, and it's great food. You can have Peruvian, you can have Ethiopian.
I think you've also got a thing about whether we have a culture of eating out, because places where people eat at home will just not have as a vibrant and eating out culture. So again, it might be a great place to eat, but you've got to be able to be invited in and be within the bosom of an existing family rather than be at a restaurant. And there are places that are a bit like that as well, where there just isn't the same culture of going out for food. Where there is, you'll have a lot more vibrancy.
Being in London has spoilt me in terms of giving me, letting me dip my toe into different cultures. So the first Brazilian meal I ever had was in London. The first Nepalese meal I ever had was in London. It goes on and on and on, you know. And I'm sure people from those countries will say, yeah, but like, this is an anglicized version of Brazilian food or whatever. But I remember having my first Argentinian meal, and I know you're a vegetarian, so I'll say this lightly.
Yeah, they do like their steak.
Holy camole. It was different cuts of this meat, and the guy who served it, and he to us, and he brought it out, and he cut it up in front of us. He said, this one's going to be like butter. This one's going to be like mushrooms. This cut, I'm like, yeah, whatever. He was spot on. This one cut of this beef was like butter. This one, it was just utterly amazing. So, but anyway, so I'd be really quite interested to hear other people's takes actually on cities that are really good for food. And I think fundamentally, I think there's two criteria. There is diversity, and then there is quality of eateries. Yeah. You know, so please call in.
Because that's not always the same thing,
is it? No, not at all, not at all. So please call in, folks. And
I barely ate a tomato for a year after I came back from Spain. Just wasn't worth it. Just like, or an avocado for that matter. I was like, I've had the good stuff. I'm not putting up with what you can buy in a supermarket in the UK. It was just dreadful. I had to reacclimatise myself to the kind of tomatoes we get here. They did not have the same punch.
Did you spend much time in Madrid when you were in Spain?
I was there for a weekend, but no, I was mainly in Andalusia.
Oh, okay. Well, I knew you were down south. I can't remember what they call it, but it's the Madrid version of tapas. It's more substantial than tapas, and they call it whatever the is. And we went out at 11 o'clock midnight.
Rafiones?
You know, even if you said the name, I wouldn't remember, to be honest with you. But it was just glorious. And there's something very, you do pat yourself on the back and say, how cosmopolitan am I? You're eating out in a a semi-street restaurant at midnight having this food, which you can barely pronounce, all tastes great, and you stood up and whatever, and it was an amazing experience, an amazing culinary experience, but also a great cook and a cultural experience. So please call in, folks. Tell us which cities you think are actually great for dining out, but be clear with your criteria. Is this, does it have loads of great restaurants and the quality of the food, or is this great range of diversity? But I need to thank you for that rather good question, Nicole. We have one more call, and it's somebody who, I think she might know one of the podcasters here.
Hi, Map Corner. I am calling to ask about world maps. Of all the world maps that have been made, I know that the one most commonly seen in most classrooms, etc., isn't an accurate representation. Which map is the best to represent the world? Thanks.
That's my kid's mother. So thank you for that, Megan. What do you reckon, Claire?
I thought you weren't going to give her a name then. I think that's not a very kind of complimentary way of referring to someone. Well, it's a very hotly debated thing. And we've had a few things come in on the Facebook page about alternative projections. And it's certainly a subject which rages amongst the mapping community on Twitter. So I hesitate to express a preference, to be honest. I think if we were all brought up on Mercator, somehow other things look skewed when in fact it's the other way around, which is just a bit daft, really, isn't it? I quite like the ones that kind of split the world up in weird and different ways, like the ones that create geodesic domes and that kind of thing, because it makes you look at it in different ways. And I quite like the ones that sort of take an epicenter in a different place, because again, if you're taking a different projection, that immediately changes your perspective by not looking at it with, you know, America on the left and Japan on the right, sort of, and taking it in that normal approach. I quite like having my perspective shifted, not just by the projection, but by the sort of epicenter of a map. So I don't know, but I just like all sorts of maps, really. So I'm
what
not
do you
fussy.
Mean you don't know. You just said, yeah, I don't know, after being really clear and erudite with your answer. Then you just said, ended it with, I don't know. You obviously do know.
I don't have a preference. I like lots of different kinds of maps. And I'm not like, you know, I'm not wedded to one over another. I don't think any of them are hateful. I mean, there are people who have incredibly strong feelings on this. And I understand why. But I just don't get that excited about the different types. I just enjoy them. I enjoy them all. That make more sense?
Yeah, no, it does. I think, and you did kind of touch on this at the start of your answer, but we can't help but view each projection of the world that we see by Mercator, because it's the one we've seen the most. So even if we don't want to admit it, subconsciously, that is our norm. And we understand that the countries that are further away from the equator are more distorted. They appear bigger. So Greenland looks massive when actually it's smaller than Mexico. But in terms of understanding where the countries are in the world and their relationships to each other, I think Mercator does a good job. Yes, Russia is way too big. Yes, Canada gets scarily big, or you know, Baffin Island, et cetera, et cetera. But just understanding physically where Spain is, where Burkina Faso is, where Mozambique is, where Peru is, it's a great map. Though I do like when you get one of them is called a transverse Mercator projection, which when you see it, it's almost as if the world's continents are all one kind of landmass. And it's a really interesting projection, because if you imagine Alaska down to South America, you know, it's the two continents, North America and South America, are connected by this thin slither of land, Central America. But then if you imagine the very end of South America, almost just kind of touch you with the Falkland Islands, the tip of Antarctica.
Mm-hmm.
So, and what you see through that map is this kind of trail of a broken land bridge that goes all the way from Antarctica, South America, North America, across the Bering Strait into Asia. And then, of course, Asia then connects to Africa. And it's fascinating actually to see the world in that way, that all the land masses are kind of connected or almost connected. But simply to answer your question, Megan, there is no projection which squares the circle, so to speak, because the inherent problem is that the world is a ball and you're flattening it somehow. And when you flatten it, there is some level of distortion somewhere. So all of these new projections, or newer ones than Mercator, try to take that into account, but have big compromises that they need to make. So when you talked about, Claire, about those projections which have the different kind of hemispheres, which it always reminds me of the 1970s. It seems to be the 1970s when that kind of view of the world kind of came into its own. But it's weird because you think, right, there is a big physical gap between, let's say, Europe and North America, or for Africa and Australia, you know. So there's always compromises that these projections need to make. But I'll be somewhat controversial and say, just to understand where countries are in the world and our relationship to them, wherever you actually are, Mercator is a good place to start. But mm-hmm. don't just look at Mercator, because with different projections, you see different relationships between the land masses, which are pretty interesting.
I'm just looking at, there's a thing you posted to the Facebook group, which is a web page from Jason Davies Maps, which just looks at different map projections. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, it's kind of psychedelic. I'm finding myself quite hypnotized by it. And it just really emphasizes how those different projections starting in different places can do very strange things to the size and shape of different countries across the globe. So I recommend that.
Cool. Being as we're on Facebook, is there any other Facebook action on our Facebook group that you'd like to tell us about?
Oh, there's been loads of Facebook action because we've not recorded for a while. So there's been all sorts going on.
And whose fault is that?
So
gallivanting throughout the world without a care for your listeners.
Throughout the world with all the IT required to record, which I bought specially to take on holiday with me. And did someone call me and do a recording? No, they didn't. So I'll just put that there. So anyway,
I've been told
we have had some I finally had some interesting other places to do recordings from, and did we? No. Anyway, moving on. So we've had some really interesting ideas for some future conversations. Especially enjoyed the post that Witherspoon made around the AAA triptychs, the maps that were created for people's, like, pure personally curated road trip maps from America. I just love the idea of these, and I think it would be great to do a bit more of a feature on those. So I would love to come back to that in a future episode. I really liked the, having just been on some very long plane flights, Liz Villa-Lobos sent a thing around how the maps that you can see on the seat back in front of you when you're on a long distance flight, they are looking at ways of monetizing those, and they're calling it geotainment. Now, frankly, watching the route map on a 17-hour flight when I went from London to Perth was geotainment enough for me. I really liked that. I found some interesting places I'd never heard of. And, you know, oh my God, Central Asia takes a heck of a long time to go over. That's all I'll say. But I love that, that thing in an aeroplane when it tells you where you're at and what you're seeing and what's behind you and so on. But this is about sort of giving you more information, overlaying from where you are with something a little bit more kind of intuitive, in terms of providing a kind of more detail and ultimately, obviously, selling your stuff about either the places you're going to or the places you've gone by, because all these things have to be monetized somehow. But I thought that was quite an interesting concept. So that's worth looking at if you're interested in what it looks like to sit in a plane and look at the map in front of you. And also a couple of
there
people.
Was one minute there, Claire. One second. There's something in the news, and this is, I'm so rubbish. There was something in the news in the last month about the upgrade that in-flight maps are going to get. And I'll just say that I cannot remember what exactly it was, but it was worth the effect of more people watch their little blue dot on the screen when they fly, then people realize it people do find it entertaining. And some companies come in with some new software which is going to allow you to do all manner of things when you put your finger on the screen.
Yes,
that's but this. What exactly those things were, I cannot remember. Oh, I'll shut up then. Okay.
I think that was probably the article that was shared on the Facebook page. But yeah, I agree. And I imagine that everyone listening to this and as a member of the online Facebook community are the kind of people who, when on a flight, are watching the map above other things. Not all the time. I watch some other things on the flights, but I did spend a lot of time defaulting to the map because who wouldn't? Maps are great. And a couple of really great maps that were shared on the Facebook site were beautiful sort of artist poster maps by a guy called Joe Mora, one of California, and another one, I think it was of possibly the Grand Canyon or something like that. And I looked up Joe Mora because I thought it was just so beautiful. And he was a sort of cartoonist and artist and a cowboy who lived, you know, out in the far west of America and in also the South America. He's from Uruguay. He was born in 1876. And so he saw kind of the end of, I guess, what would be considered sort of the old west and the beginning of a modern age. And he does some beautiful, beautiful maps. Definitely look up Joe Mora because they're just, you know, amazing works of art. I mean, he was an artist in his own right, doing all sorts of other things as well, but he took a lot of inspiration from his work, you know, out on ranches in California, and also his understanding of Native American kind of tradition. So one to look at. I really appreciated people sharing those because they were beautiful. And just one final mention on the Facebook around something that John Soltani shared, which was this sort of live map of where earthquakes happen around the globe, which was, well, makes you grateful that you're not in a place where one's happening, of course. But it was a really, actually, it was one of those other things. It was an animation and it just became a really beautiful animation. It's another way that, you know, the visual presentation of information, which is what a map is, really, can be beautiful as well as informative.
You know, it has to be said, all the time that I've spent in the Bay Area, I've never been there when there's been an earthquake. Twice I've left for a weekend away and people have said, oh, did you feel the small tremor? I'm like, what? No, I've missed it again. So I do almost feel like I haven't quite got my Bay Area stripes because I've never been there when there's been that low bass rumble and a picture has just randomly fallen off of a wall. You know, people say that you can blink and miss them, you know, but when you're conscious and you've been through one, you do then kind of like know what's happening. But like, yeah, but I've never been through one and I kind of feel like I'm a bit of a
fool lucky charm
in the Bay Area, you know, being there off and on for 5 years.
Maybe while you're there, maybe you're some sort of San Francisco superhero that you physically being there stops the place having earthquakes. That will appeal to you because you're such a superhero guy.
There you go.
You like superheroes, not that you are one.
That is very true. I got what you meant. I got what you meant. Though I do like to tuck my shirt into my underpants, whatever. But anyway, so that's Facebook dealt with. Did we have any action on Twitter? And of course, to find us on Facebook, quite simply go onto Facebook and type in Map Corner.
Absolutely. Twitter's quieter, and I have to say, quite a lot of the traffic on the Map Corner hashtag on Twitter is me. Although we did have a great post from Catherine Rowan Jones around areas of Britain that are more than 15 miles from a waterway. Now, that sounds really quite sort of niche, but it actually gives you a real feel for this was in the kind of pre-industrial age, and that's how people got stuff around. So it just shows you which areas were particularly geographically isolated by way of not being near water, in a way that mattered then and matters less now that we have, you know, roads and railways and stuff. I've done a few up there, which I, of all of the ones that I like, there was the one about, they did an experiment where they dropped a wallet in different countries, different cities around the world, and saw how many of them came back or were handed in. Interesting, that one. I have to say that Iberian Peninsula, not good. You know, some places do better than others. If you're going to lose your wallet, you want to do it in Helsinki, because the chances of getting it back are very substantially better than Lisbon or Madrid. That was an interesting one. I also just saw the thing that was posted to, I think it might have been Ken who posted it on the Facebook group, about kind of web searches in Europe, and I think Spain and Portugal were also pretty dubious ones. So I don't know what's going on there, what it says about the national character, if true. So, but I would say, sorry, you carry on.
No, I was going to say that I actually thought I'd really like to look at the methodology of how they came up with that study, because it's one thing to say we dropped a wallet in London. Where in London? You know, did you drop it in Kensington or in Knightsbridge, or did you drop it in Harlesden, or did you drop it in Walthamstow, you know, or in Bow? You know, these are areas which have very different socioeconomic profiles.
Yeah.
So,
well, London scored 5 out of 12 returns, so just under 50%.
But still, though, right, their methodology needs to be examined. I think, don't get me wrong, it makes for tweetable content. It's the type of thing, oh, look at that.
Yeah.
The Finns, they're honest. You know, oh, look at the people from, I don't know, Ulaanbaatar, thieves, a lot of them, right? It makes for interesting, tweetable. Listen, we've got no listeners in Ulaanbaatar, so I can say that and just about get away with it. But yes, how many wallets? How did they pick the areas? Did the socioeconomic difference between the areas of each city, did they match up with the other cities? You know, need that level of detail.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because Rio and Zurich scored the same number of returns. So, I'd suggest that they have slightly different makeups.
And I saw that and I thought to myself, I want to see the methodology. I actually don't want to see the methodology because I've got a life to live. However, right, if I was sat in front of the... But yes. Anything else on the Twitters?
Well, I cannot go without giving a little mention to one that I tweeted a few weeks ago, actually, in April, which was picking up on something we did discuss last time, which was about population density. And it was the population density of the UK in Joy Division style. And I'm a little bit young for Joy Division, but, it's a really iconic image, the sort of Joy Division album cover. And if you haven't seen it, go back onto the Twitter at the hashtag MacPorner and scroll down till you find it, because it's just a thing of beauty. And it's such a clever idea and such an obvious one when you see it. But you know, it's just a lovely piece of art, really, in the way that the original Joy Division cover, I guess, was a beautiful piece of art. But it's saying something also about the population of the UK. So definitely would recommend that one as my favourite map of the last few weeks.
No, that was absolutely stunning. So whoever did that needs a pat on the back and a gold star, because it was utterly clever, utterly clever. But it did remind me of an incident which happened just last year. I was out with my daughter Ella, and she said, "I really like that T-shirt." And I went, "What, the Joy Division one?" She went, "Dad, how do you know that's Joy Division? Because they're really cool." I went, "I beg your pardon." and it really underlined the fact that she saw me as an old fart. But I think more importantly than that, because, you know, teenagers are supposed to think that your parents are just not with it. Massive difference between kids today and us when we were growing up and subsequent generations. When it comes to popular music, we had a real appreciation of the chronology of popular music. Elvis was the 50s, the Beatles were the 60s, the 70s were, let's say, ABBA and soul and whatever, and, da, 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 da. And then New Romantics and New Wave of the early 80s. And kids now, music is just a thing. It's around them all the time.
Yeah, it's a digitization, isn't it?
And they don't tribally follow genres. Exactly. They don't follow genres the way that we used to. And so for her, I said, "You do know this is really old music?" And she went, "No, I just know that it's cool." I went, "It's like Joy Division, Love Will Tear Us Apart. It's like 1980. And she went, "How do you know all this?" I went, "Because I was there." Right. You know, but for her, it's an iconic image. Yeah. And then she hears the music and she doesn't assign it to an era. It's not 80s music. It's just music. Yeah.
Well, it's nice that they see the image at all, to be fair.
It utterly floored me.
Yeah, you know, you don't always get to see the image these days. I mean, that's one of the things I miss. I'm coming out all old world now. But, one of the things I miss from the days of vinyl, which is interesting to see how vinyl's made such a resurgence, actually, because of that, the tactile feeling of getting something substantial to, you know, in a proper old LP record and a nice inner sleeve, and all the, you know, lyrics on the sleeve and the extra photos and a gatefold album cover. Wasn't that nice?
The paper inner sleeve.
Yeah, all of that. And that, it was never the same to have a cassette tape or a CD. And, and digital's a whole other thing again. So I can understand that kind of visceral connection to doing music with that thing to hold. Because I guess, but then that's because I grew up with that. So that's what feels normal. It's interesting to see how people who haven't grown up with it, or maybe grew up with CDs, which, you know, weren't quite the same thing, have suddenly taken to vinyl. I don't know if that's a UK thing or a worldwide thing, but you can buy vinyl LPs in my local supermarket. And, you know, modern, you know, not just historic ones, but, like, you know, on re-release, but new ones. And, yeah, it seems so strange, especially because I sold all my old vinyl years ago in a big job lot because no one wanted it, and I was fed up with carting it around from one place to another, and now I wish I'd held on to it all. There you go. You live and learn.
You do. That's just about us done on the Twitters, isn't it?
But, you know, I'm there practically on my own. So if you see stuff on Twitter, hashtag Map Corner, and I will find it.
Yay. I think that's us just about done, folks. We've done the Facebook, we've done the Twitter. We are going to give you a roll call next week of everybody that's written us a review. So please go on to Apple Podcasts and write us a review. That's been me, somewhat tired, well, just about soldiered through, but Claire has manfully, he said in parentheses, held the show together. So well done to you, Claire. And maybe in the next episode, we'll not only have your audio postcard, but you'll tell us a little bit about your travels through the great dry continent. And remember, if you want to add your voice to the show, you go onto mapcorner.space and hit the little red tab over on the right hand side where it says voicemail and send us a voicemail. Is there anything we forgot to mention that we should?
No, I think that's probably enough gabbing on, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Oh, I couldn't even shut you up this week.
I was quite polite in places.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.